Hey there, welcome to LiveWire. I'm your host, Luke Burbank. We have a really fun show in store for you this week. I mean, we always try to have fun on the program, but like this week, it's going to be really fun. First, we're talking to comedian and author Moshe Kasher about his latest book, Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes. It highlights all these different lives that he's lived, including his time, as he puts it, being the boy king of AA, which he started attending when he was 15 years old. Also his time working as a security guard at Burning Man. Plus, we're going to hear some stand-up from the brilliant Mohamed El Sheki, who might be the most dangerous man in New York City, or maybe just the most misunderstood based on a recent interaction with his neighbor. Plus, we're going to hear some music from indie rock band sensation Glitter Fox. So that's the plan, Stan, and people with other names. Stick around. LiveWire gets started right after this.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Luke. How's it going?
It's going so well. I am curious, though, if you are emotionally and mentally ready to play a little round of station location identification examination.
I am. I hope I'm physically ready, too. I did a few deep knee bends, so
okay,
let's do this.
All right. You sound ready. This is where I quiz Elena about a place in the country where LiveWire is on the radio. She's got to guess where I'm talking about. This place is one of the oldest place names in the Great Lakes. The name is French for big marsh, which is kind of puzzling as there is apparently no marsh in this place.
Is Marsh Marais in French?
Oh,
is
my gosh.
Grand Marais?
What? It's Grand Marais, Minnesota.
I didn't know what state that was in. I just know a little French.
I don't. That is really impressive. By the way, just because people might want to know this, it's also the eastern entry point for the largest international dark sky sanctuary in the world. So if you're trying to enter that area from the east, you're going to go through Grand Marais, Minnesota, where we are on the radio on WLSN. That was impressive, Elena.
Well, I had some pressure because I met an awesome LiveWire listener at our most recent live show, Rita, and Rita really likes to get the sly right, so I wanted to do good for Rita. Shout out to Rita.
Message received. All right, let's try to ride this momentum wave right into the show. You ready to get to it?
Let's do it.
All right, take it away.
From PRX, it's
LiveWire!
This week, comedian and author Moshe Kasher.
So, like, my message is, if your drug dealer ever does an intervention on you, it is time to seek help.
And stand-up comedy from Mohamed El Sheki.
A friend of mine, her biggest fear is that one day she will be killed by a serial killer. And I was like, I don't think that's going to happen here. Also, she lives on like a fifth floor walk-up. And I was like, even your loved ones don't want to come see you.
With music from Glitter Fox and our fabulous house band. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello. And now, the host of LiveWire, Luke Burbank.
Thank you so much, Elena. Thanks to everyone tuning in from all over the country, including Grand Marais, Minnesota. We have such a fun, funny, but also informative episode of the show for you this week. Of course, we have asked the LiveWire listeners a question. We asked, what is the most niche subculture you've ever been part of? This is because of Moshe Kasher's latest book. We're going to hear those responses coming up in a few minutes. First, though, of course, we got to kick things off with the best news we heard all week. This is our little reminder at the top of the show. There's some good news happening out there. Elena, what is the best news you heard all week?
Oh, I love this news from down under. I will spare you the accent. Australia news. So there's a beach in Sydney called Manly Beach, and apparently it's a favorite place for swimmers to go and do some pretty hardcore oceanic swimming. And for the past 3 years, nearly every morning at 4 a.m., a man named Guy Dunstan shows up with a headlamp and a meat thermometer, and he takes the temperature of the water, and then he goes over to a concrete drainage pillar that's along the beach wall, and he makes a pretty decent-sized mural. It's kind of artful. It's different every day, but each time it communicates the water temperature to the swimmers, which tells them how to dress. Do they need the wetsuit? Maybe they shouldn't try it at all today. And one recent 4 a.m., he noticed this bottle in the surf, and there was a message inside the bottle, just like the police song.
We were all thinking it.
And the message read, "In this bottle is a small part of our parents. If you find it, please set it off once again on its journey." And it turns out that there are these two sons named Kevin and Nigel who had recently lost both their parents, who loved the ocean. And so they'd thrown the bottle into Bondi Beach, which is only about 7 nautical miles away. So it didn't really get that far. But Guy Dunstan is like the coolest dude in the world. So he had a friend with a sailboat. And once he was done making his temperature mural, they sailboated out past the Sydney Harbor, past the bay where the currents are stronger. So then he set the bottle on its way, and now it's going to go somewhere even further. I just love this. I love this story. And if you want to follow Guy Dunstan and his escapades, you can follow him on Instagram at @temperature_guy _manly.
That's also just such a lovely thing for the memory of the parents of those folks, this idea that, you know, a little bit of them will travel around in this bottle, and it's an afterlife in of sorts for these folks, these parents.
And it's traveling via the internet now because everyone's talking about this story thanks to Guy. So it's really, what a great legacy to leave behind for these sea-loving folks.
Absolutely. Best news that I heard this week happened a little closer to home. It happened actually in Spokane, Washington.
Hey, hey.
There in the old Inland Empire in Washington State, where the March Madness college basketball tournament was occurring. And you had the team from Yale who had qualified for the tournament. But the problem was it also was coinciding with when they were taking their spring break. And so they didn't have enough members of the Yale band. Basically, Yale couldn't field a marching band to support their basketball team. And so the athletic director of Yale reached out to the athletic director, at least the music director of the University of Idaho, the Vandals, and asked, "Would you consider sending your marching band over to the game to be like the Yale marching band, to stand in, to be a surrogate for our band that can't make it?" And this director of athletic bands is his official title, Spencer Martin, put this out on the internet, like there at Idaho, and immediately had 29 people sign up for it, which is the maximum you're allowed to actually bring as a marching band, I learned.
29 Vandals.
29 Vandals, or as they were calling themselves for these purposes, Van Dogs, because Yale is the Bulldogs.
Right.
So they get these like 29 members of the Idaho Vandals marching band together. They, of course, don't really know the Yale like songs and chants. So they're on their phones, like learning the Yale fight song and the bus on the way from Idaho over to Spokane. And they were so enthusiastic and great that, in fact, Yale won its first game of the tournament. And, you know, it's unclear if it was just that all of that excitement and encouragement from these Van Dogs or not. But it sounds like the kids from Idaho had a super fun time.
I think this is just confirming my suspicion is that the most important thing in sports is the band.
100%. Years from now, no one will remember what the final score was against San Diego State. What we will remember is the friendship that was shared from the Idaho Vandals band on behalf of the Yale Bulldogs. So that right there, that's the best news that I saw this week. All right, let's welcome our first guest on over to the program. He's actually kind of hard to sum up in one of these little intros, Elena, because, you know, he's done a lot of stuff. Thankfully, he's also now written an entire book about his various lives, including his time as the boy king of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how he describes it. His stint as a rave promoter, turned DJ, turned Burning Man security guard, also how he became a sign language interpreter. And then he also gets into the thing that we all mostly know him for, which is his career as a stand-up comedian. The book is Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes. The New York Times calls it part history lesson, part stand-up set, and part love letter. This is our interview with Moshe Kasher, recorded at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Portland.
Moshe!
What's up?
Hey, man, so good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Glad to be back. I have a tale to tell.
Okay.
When I got the email, Livewire would like you to come back, I thought this is the end of the circle. I published my first book. It's called Kasher and the Rye, The True Tale of a White... Oh, you laughing because there's a similarly titled book? Is that what's going on there? Yeah, I found out about it after I wrote my book. It's a weird coincidence. The subtitle is The True Tale of a White Boy from Oakland Who Became a Drug Addict, Criminal, Mental Patient, and Then Turned 16. Right? I'm on book tour. It's the first book I've ever written. It's the biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my
life. This is for Kasher and the Rye.
For Kasher and the Rye. And I came here, and I came outside and opened my phone, and there was a guy from Oakland who texted me, an old friend. He goes, people in Oakland are looking for you. They're very upset. And then I swear to God, there will be no elaborations.
What?
I was like, oh, okay, Mr. Gambino. I didn't like... So since I came to Livewire, I have not felt at home in my hometown since. And I feel like now I'm 44. It's been 11 years since that book came out. I'm going to finally go back to Oakland and walk with my head held high.
Yes.
Confident that if someone tries to murder me, you got my back.
100%. I mean, are they going to mess with a guy with a carnation in his lapel that he borrowed from a bouquet in the lobby? I don't think so. And by the way, I hope there will be some elaboration, because that's what makes for a good story.
Well, I can elaborate. What happens when you write a memoir is that, especially when you're young, is that the people that are swimming around in your memory and the people that are in the kind of traumatic shards of your past, they exist in your mind, if you get enough space away from them, as memory. And they cease in the rearview mirror to remain human beings. And then when you grew up with the kind of people I grew up with, while you're writing, you go, these people aren't going to read my book.
Right.
They haven't written that. My friends didn't read. They never read. Guess who reads the book where they're mentioned? Everybody.
Yes.
Everybody reads the book. Yeah. And everybody read the book. And I was writing as a comedian, just like them. There was Pathological Liar Blank. And then there was this. Everybody read the book. And these were people that had been in and out of prison since I left Oakland.
Yeah.
I know what I look like, and I do not paint a swath as the kind of guy that had friends like that. I look more like my friends are sort of heavy in the podcasting and graphic novel community.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
They all read the book, and people were mad. And it was to be honest, it was a growing experience. It made me realize for the second book, like, everybody you write about is a human being, and they're not a part of your story. They exist in your memory, they exist in your mind, but they're still there, and they still have agency. And it made me grow up a little bit.
Mm. I'm realizing that the school district, whoever was, had it wrong trying to give us pizza to read books when I was a kid. They should have wrote about us in the books. Because nothing drives literacy like knowing you're in the book.
Well, that's why I keep writing memoirs, because I know for sure I am going to be in that book.
There's something at the beginning of this, Moshe, that is a big turning point in your life that I was really interested in and also kind of impressed by. You had just gotten sober. I mean, 6 days sober, I think.
Yeah.
And you're invited to a New Year's Eve party. Or some sort of party that is definitely going to end your sobriety, your very, you know, brief sobriety at that point.
Well, I got sober on December 25th, 1994. I was 15 years old, And I had been in and out of rehab since I was about 13, almost 14 years old. And I was in therapy from the time I was 4 until the state funding ran out when I was 15, almost 16 years old. And I had this problem with adults. That was my big thing. I had this problem with adults. I hated adults. Every adult was like a cop or the principal or my mom, and all of them were always telling me what to do. And then I had this kind of otherworldly I don't know where it came from, where a 15-year-old sort of juvenile delinquent has this thought, but I had this realization, like a light. What is it possible that every single person around you is wrong and you're right?
People go through their whole life and never figure that out. I'm serious. You know what I mean? Like, amazing that you and this, you decide to go to what sounds like the world's worst sober New Year's Eve party instead of this fun young person party. And I don't understand how, as a 15-year-old, you had that sense of like the big picture.
Well, that's the issue, right? Is that I realized I needed to stop. And I had this secondary realization, which was that I couldn't. And that is a really terrifying place to be. I remember how I realized that. I went to my drug dealer's house, and I paid him for yesterday's bag, and I declared that I was done. I was like, goodbye, my friend. Adios. I'm on to another life. And he was like, whatever. The next day, when I went to his house to buy another bag, he looked at me, and he goes, dude, what are you doing here? You said you quit yesterday. Here you are again today. He's like, man, you've really got a problem. So, like, my message is, if your drug dealer ever does an intervention on you, it is time to seek help.
I want to, speaking of drug dealers, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about your time as a sober drug dealer, which are not words that are usually close together in the same sentence, but we are going to hear about that when we talk to Moshe Kasher a little bit more. The book is Subculture Vulture. This is Livewire from PRX. We'll be back in just a moment. To Livewire. I'm Luke Burbank here with Lena Passarella. We're talking to Moshe Kasher about his latest book, Subculture Vulture. You talk about 6 different subcultures that you have personal experience with. One of the things that's really great about the book is it's a great combination of memoir and research. Like, you really clearly enjoyed the scholarly aspect of researching these different subcultures, including another subculture you found yourself in, during your sobriety, which was the rave scene. There's so much more Jenko Jeans writing in this book than I was expecting. Judge none, choose one, by the way. That's what the Jenko stands for.
Is that
what?
I didn't know that. Perhaps you are the scholar, Luke.
Well, you know, I dabble.
Actually, the AA dance on New Year's Eve ports directly into raves. So I went to the drug dealer. I couldn't stop. And I finally sought help. 15 years old, I walked into a young people's meeting. I looked around. I was the youngest person by 10 years at a young people's meet. These people were like gross old, like 25. It was like disgusting. And I found something in the meeting that allowed me to like stay sober. That sort of cliche of like one day at a time, which I always hated because it felt like an insult. It's like, I know you say one day at a time, but you really mean like one day at a time for the rest of time, say goodbye to having a good time. And it was enough though. And I started to piece together these days, 1 day, 2 day, 3 day, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days. I got invited to this party and I was 15. That's all I wanted to do was go to a party. That's like, that is mana from the heavens for a 15-year-old. And I hadn't been invited to a party in years.
And you're talking about this fun party.
Like a real
with
party.
With people your age, yeah, not the AA mixer.
Well, there was another option that evening, which was an AA dance. Like, has anybody ever been to, I'll describe an AA dance. Like, picture the energy of like Studio 54 in the height of the 70s, right? Picture Coachella at the EDM tent, right? Like after the headliner is done and all the partiers go to the EDM tent to like squeeze a little bit more fun out of their night, right? You have that picture? Mm-hmm. Okay, picture the exact opposite of that energy. That is what an AA dance feels like. It's the worst. It's at a Rotary Club. Picture a man with an emphysema oxygen tank dancing to like a former sex worker to like It's Raining Men at 9:45 p.m. That's sort of the picture. These are my options as a 15-year-old, 6 day sober drug addict. Like, good party, cool people, fun times, or Rotary Club. And I chose Rotary Club. Like somehow another moment of providence, I chose Rotary Club. And I remember I found the one other person under 30 at the dance. Rose was her name. And we sat under a fluorescent light outside smoking Newports and talking about how much our lives sucked. And at 12:01, my mommy came and picked me up. It was the worst. It was the worst New Year's of my life. But now I've had a lot of fun. Over the years, I've gotten to be a DJ at raves on New Year's Eve. I've gotten to be a headlining comedian at clubs on New Year's Eve. I've gotten to travel the world at different New Year's. I've had a lot of fun. In hindsight, which I really think is the theme of the book, is hindsight. I realized that night, smoking those cigarettes under that light, that was the most important New Year's of my life because it was the New Year's, it was the moment where I chose my life and what the rest of my life would look like. That was my resolution, was I wanted to live.
I think it's so impressive that at that age, your brain or some part of you was able to connect with that idea because mm-hmm. people struggle with that their whole life potentially. And it would be very understandable if a 15-year-old kid was like, I'm doing the much more obviously fun thing, but you didn't, which allowed you then to have this incredible life, which did include a period of time selling drugs at raves while a sober person. How did you square that in your young, still very young mind at this point?
Well, it was much like drugs, a degree of tolerance, you know. I slowly built up my tolerance, you know. I didn't start at raves as an ecstasy dealer. I ended at raves as an ecstasy dealer. And that's a really awkward thing because I was still clean and sober. I might be the world's first clean and sober ecstasy dealer, but the problem was people from the meeting would sometimes come to the rave. And it'd be me, and then I see a guy from the meeting come in, Gads, good to see you, recovery brother. From the Tuesday night meeting. That's where I ended. Yeah. But where I started was not negative. It was where I started was as, I would say, as healing a kind of force as AA was for me. The first party I ever went to, again, I was 16 years old, and I walked into this party super trying to be a gangster, like identity crisis guy. Like, I had a Southern accent back then. I'm not from the South. You know, I just like had it. And I would code switch too. I would like be talking to my brother and I'd be like, well, anyway, David, you know, I don't know what we're gonna do. Hold on a second, I'm getting a telephone call. Hello, what's up, my man? Yeah, we out here. All right then, peace. And I'd turn back to him, he'd be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? So that's the guy I was in line.
There's so much in this book that I want to talk about. It's so many different parts of your life and huge topics that you really get into. I don't know if we're gonna have time for all of it, but one of the things that you write about is that you are a CODA child of deaf adults.
Yeah.
And both of your parents are deaf. Your father was deaf. I'm wondering, when I was a kid, everything my parents did in public was deeply mortifying to me. Anything, like we would hold hands and pray before dinner, like at a McDonald's, which would be pretty.
You'd be like praying to go to a different restaurant?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, that was where we had the entertainment book coupon for, so that's where we were going to be. But I'm wondering, for you to be a child of deaf parents and to end up doing a lot of translating, it sounds like, particularly for your mom, in situations where you were delivering the information from the school administrator that you were being kicked out of school to your mother, were you tempted to dilute the message?
Well, that's a very delicate dance, actually. I mean, I spent the first 15 years of my life the way all CODAs do, which is in an extensive, non-consensual sign language interpretation internship program. I interpreted for everything for my mom. I mean, this was before the ADA, before interpreters were mandated to be there, and I would walk into an emergency room visit with my mom sick and realize if I wasn't there, my mom literally wouldn't understand the care she was going to be offered. And that was that was when I was 8, 7, 8, 9 years old. And then when like you said, the subject of the meetings that I was required to translate for became increasingly about me and my own behavioral issues, I would have to do this kind of sort of weird dance where you can't be like, yeah, tell them, my mom, the unadulterated message. But I also couldn't be like, the Oakland Police Department thinks this kid's A-okay, because my mom would be like, okay, I smell a rat. Like, so you'd have to kind of do kind of a, you know, weird, like, oh, well, he does have some issues. We did want to talk, but actually we think he shows great promise. In fact, we think maybe a memoirist could be in his future, you know, like.
I did not know this until I read the book that Alexander Graham Bell, of all people, did such immense harm to the deaf community through this idea of something that you describe as oralism, this obsession with trying to get deaf folks to basically conform to hearing folks' idea of how communication works.
The craziest, most tragic part of that, or I sort of, from a literary storytelling perspective, is that the only reason that the oral movement was ever able to impose what I call like an imperialism upon the deaf community. And what was craziest about that is the only reason that the hearing society was aware of the fact that they could communicate and impose their communication standards upon the deaf community was because of sign language. Deafness is not the disability. The problem is that the hearing has this cascading effect of cutting people off from language. And one day, through an insane story, truly a French priest was walking down the street and saw two deaf sisters signing back and forth to one another. And he looked at it and realized that what he was looking at was language. Prior to that, if you were born into a family, like most deaf people are, the only deaf person in your family, you would not receive language because there wasn't a sign system to be given to you. And this priest saw that language and he said, that is language, I know it. And he wanted to teach, he asked them, teach me what you're doing. They taught him to sign, and he taught them French. And from that interaction, they started the first school for the deaf in France. They started the first recognized sign system. They started teaching these deaf people French, and they would literally bring them on road shows. And there'd be like a hearing administrator who would receive a question from the audience, like some French question, like what degree of suffering can be borne by man or whatever.
Highfalutin.
And he would turn to the deaf students and he would sign to them from French into sign, and they would receive the sign with their eyes and then get up to a chalkboard and write in perfect French, there is no degree of suffering that man cannot bear. Suffering is endless. We are French. And like... and that's the beginning of sign language. And one of those students was Laurent Clerc, who became the father of American Sign Language. And the world had this revelation, which is, oh, deaf people are linguistic. And almost immediately when they realized that, hearing people said, let's take away that language and teach them how to speak and look more like us. And it wasn't about whether it was the most successful system. It was about making hearing people comfortable around them. And the father of that movement, and in many ways the progenitor of it, was Alexander Graham Bell, himself a coda, himself married to a deaf person. And in many ways, he was like a boogeyman, because oralism won, because of course it did. And oralism won until the deaf community took their language back and put a fist through that oralist glass ceiling and took their world back.
Yeah. We're talking to Moshe Kasher here on Livewire. His new book is Subculture Vulture. Again, everybody get the book, read it. There's so much in here, and I wish we could talk about all of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I went to Burning Man for a long time. My dad was a Hasidic Jew, and also I do stand-up comedy.
We are running short on time, but I do want to talk to you a little bit about Burning Man, because I've met you as a popular comedian, and what I think of when I think of cool popular comedians are people that are so steeped in irony, there's almost no, or it's like, it's not very cool to be authentically, genuinely excited about something anymore, and you authentically love Burning Man in a way that really humanized you to me and made me see this other version of you than like, you just love Burning Man.
Well, that sounds insulting when you say it like that.
I don't mean it to be.
Could be the kind of thing, if you're walking down the street in Portland and somebody points at you and says it, other people will turn and say, avoid that man. You love Burning Man.
But I think you make a really good defense of this thing that so many people have so much judgment around.
Yeah.
And why you love it and why you say you might take your kid there someday. What is it about Burning Man that the people that are so dismissive of it are getting wrong?
Well, I think I love people, and I love communities that live a little bit outside the margins, you know? And I think that that's what deafness and Hasidic Judaism, the two subcultures that aren't really subcultures, if we're being honest, they're cultures. They're perhaps a little bit to the left of the dominant culture, but that's the bucket I was born into, Hasidic Judaism and ultra-Orthodox Judaism and deafness. And those two worlds gave me this kind of appreciation for people that like to do things differently. And that's what raves were, and in many ways that's what AA is. It's people that are their natural state should be in obliteration, but in fact is in recovery. And what Burning Man, I think, gets so right is this idea that life has these parts to it that can be experienced for the pleasure only, for the experience only, that not everything needs to have inherent meaning. And like, is Burning Man a utopia? No, but it's not supposed to be a utopia. It's supposed to be a fake utopia. Mm. When you take a psychedelic, you have this experience of being subsumed into a kind of like a spiritual reality, but in fact, you have to come down. But you hope that you come out of your psychedelic experience having shifted ever so slightly. Well, I gave up psychedelics when I was 12, 13, 14 years old, and I kept looking through the world for a psychedelic experience that I could have clean and sober. And that's, I think, what Burning Man did for me. People always go, how could you go there sober? I go, I don't particularly, I felt high the whole time I was there. Mm. Last year was the 24th time, my 24th time attending.
Wow.
I went for the first time in 1996. I worked there for 15 years. Has it changed? Has it gotten lamer? Sure, but everything changes. Everything got lamer. I mean, I was at Livewire Radio 10 years
ago,
exactly. You know? And like. No, I'm kidding.
Moshe Kasher, everybody.
That was Moshe Kasher right here on Live Wire. His latest book, Subculture Vulture, is out and available now. Hey, special thanks this episode to Pamela Brown of Tigard, Oregon, and Michael Smith of Everett, Washington. Michael and Pamela are part of the LiveWire member community, and they are generously supporting our show with a donation each month. And we are very thankful for that, because it is no joke how we're able to keep doing our public radio show. So a big thanks to Pamela and Michael for keeping LiveWire in business. This is LiveWire. Of course, each week we ask our listeners a question because of that deep dive into various subcultures with Moshe. We asked our listeners, what is the most niche subculture you have ever been a part of? And people responded to that. Elena has been collecting up those responses. Where do you see him?
I love this one from James. James is in a unique subculture that practices partner acrobatics.
I just saw a TikTok about this.
Oh no, he's back on TikTok.
We're talking about me, not James. That's what you hear the concern in Elena's voice.
I love when you're on TikTok.
You can kind of rate my emotional well-being by how much time I'm spending on TikTok looking at things. This partner acrobatics thing is really interesting. It's like a trust fall, but with like a lot more going on, right?
It's like remember the airplane? Remember when you were a kid and people would play? It's like adult airplane.
Correct. Yes. With more flipping around, and like it's really quite something to watch. So, but it's a niche subculture that's getting less niche if I'm starting to see it on TikTok, Elena.
Because TikTok, your best friend.
For now, anyway, it just fills the hole. Anyway, hey, what's something else niche that one of our listeners is into?
Oh, I think I might have to join this subculture that Annie is a part of. Annie is among the group of axolotl owners.
Okay, axolotl owners. Is this thing living or is it inanimate?
Yeah, it's an adorable amphibian. Sometimes it's the prettiest pink color, and it's got like a little mane. It's not hair. It's like, you know, scales or something.
Okay.
It's like the size of like a salamander, and it's notorious because its face looks like it's got this big blissful smile on itself.
I was trying to find, while we were talking, I was trying to quickly search on the internet for a picture of one of these things, and I clearly cannot spell axolotl, because I just got an Italian football manager named Carlo Ancelotti, who is not smiling in any of the photos.
Well, maybe he owns an axolotl. Ancelotl has an axolotl.
Very possibly. Okay, one more niche subculture that one of our listeners is very into.
Okay, this is as niche as it gets. Ron says, this might be a subculture of one, but I have a collection of my dad's big toenails. Maybe there are others out there? Contact me. And so I'm wondering if Ron thinks there are other people who collect their dad's big toenails, or if Ron is wondering if his dad's big toenails are also being collected by someone else in the world.
That's exactly what came to mind, Elena, was, you know, you find out sometime in adulthood that you weren't the only person who had a collection of your dad's toenails.
Also, only the big toe. No pinky toenails. You know, like the only piggy is the one that went to market. None of the other ones.
That's, you know, I mean, you do you when it comes to how you... how you think about your family members and what things you treasure. But I'm genuinely hoping that that is a very niche culture, and that there aren't other people who have this guy's dad's toenail clippings, because that's going to be really hard to explain, honestly. All right. Thank you to everyone who responded to our listener question this week. We got another one coming up for next week's show, which we will reveal in just a moment. In the meantime, we've got to say hi to our next guest. He's one of our very favorite stand-up comedians out there today. He actually grew up in Benghazi, Libya, but then came to the U.S., got into comedy, ended up on Conan, ended up working at Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. And these days, he's also a writer on the hit podcast Love It or Leave It. And he hosts the podcast You Could Do That on Television. He is Mohanad El-Sheikhi, and he's been on the show, I think maybe this is his sixth appearance. And we're so glad he was able to join us on stage recently at Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. Take a listen.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone. So happy to be back in Portland. I travel a lot for comedy, and I take a lot of long flights, so I like to have fun. When I do that with my fellow passengers, here are some fun things you could do too. If you see the person in the exit row sleeping, did you know you can just walk to them and be like, is this some kind of joke to you or something? Like eyes on the sky. You could also bring some loose bolts with you and put it in your pocket. And midway through the flight, you can be like, hey, I'm not a plane expert, but are they supposed to come off like this? It's fun. I live in New York City, and a friend of mine, her biggest fear is that one day she will be killed by a serial killer. That's her biggest fear. And I was like, I don't think that's gonna happen here. Like, no one in New York has the time. You know, like, everyone in New York is busy. No one has the time to focus on their little hobbies, you know? Also, she lives on like a fifth floor walk up. And I was like, even your loved ones don't wanna come see you. There is no psycho out there, just like at Planet Fitness every day, using Stairmaster, just being like, one day I'll get Claire. She also recently told me that she doesn't believe in tipping. And I was like, maybe you should believe in having inside thoughts, you know? Like, why would you tell me that, you know? I don't want to hear that. And I was like, the only person you should be worried about is your delivery person. Like, if I walk up for five floors and I don't get a tip, I think I'm allowed some stabbies, you know, just kind of like, nothing fatal, just something in the thigh, you know, memorable. And, you know, because I use social media a lot, I you know, sometimes people like enjoy my content and they send me nice messages. Sometimes people read my name and they don't like my content, and that's fine. And they send me like little manifestos, which I don't read. And I'm always like, get to the point. I don't want to read all of this. And one guy did, you know, one guy sent me one line and all it said was, you're not funny, kill yourself. And I was like, that's a horrible thing to say to me, you know, because, you know, I am funny. But the second part, which I don't care about, I'm like, I think I'm going to pass on that. You know, because if anything, it seems like you don't like me. I like me. Why are you giving me homework? You know? Seems like you should do it. I was like, this just seems like another example of a job that an immigrant has to do because an American won't. And I was like... so stop being lazy and come and kill me. Uh, I know a lot of people have conspiracy theories, like, you know, like with TikTok now and everything, people are like, oh, yeah, the government of China is tracking us. And some are like, oh, the government in the U.S. is tracking us, which obviously, I'm like, sure, they're keeping tabs on us, but not to the level some people think they are. Because it's not that I like the U.S. government that much. I just don't believe in them. Because this is the same government that made social security cards on the most destructible paper known to man. And they were like, hey, buddy, yeah, I know you're two or whatever, but if anyone even looks at this, your life is ruined. So keep it safe. And it's always people who are like, oh, the government wants to know where I am all the time. I can't let them. I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, you live in what? Battleground Washington? Even God doesn't know where you are, you know? I don't really cook that much, so I usually get food delivered. And recently I did that, I got a text message from my food delivery person. And he was like, hey man, the door is closed. Can you come downstairs and pick your food up? So I was like, sure, I'll do that. I go downstairs and I see a man behind a glass door holding multiple bags. And he was like waving at me. And I was like, you know, these guys are busy, so I'm just gonna like grab my stuff and let him go. So I go to this man, I open the door, I take the first bag out of his hand, I'm like, thank you so much, man. And then I close the door and start walking back. And then I look back and I see the same man still waving at me. And I was like, oh, he's saying bye, you know? So I waved back. And I was like, I'm making new friends every day, what a city. And then I went back to my apartment to eat, and then I opened the bag and I was expecting my delivery. And all I find inside is a bunch of ingredients. And I was like, is this one of those restaurants that want me to make my own food from scratch? Like, I think that's just called cooking, which we're trying to avoid here. So I went and I sat on the couch, you know, to think about it. And then a minute later, it finally hit me. I was like, oh, I don't think these are ingredients. This is what we commonly refer to as groceries. I like the guy downstairs, that's not my delivery person. That's my neighbor, I've seen him around. He just forgot his key and he was waving at me to open the door for him and I just took his stuff. I thought I was getting my food delivered and I was just doing crime. And I went downstairs to look for him. I couldn't find him. I did find my food, though. So I was like, I think whatever this is, I won. And I went back to my apartment. And then 2 weeks later, I see the same man in the elevator. And I was going to explain to him what happened. But he would not make eye contact with me at all. And I was like, this makes so much sense. Because in his head, he's like, this is the most dangerous man in America. Because I took his food out of his hand. And I was like, thank you. Closed the door. Walked all the way back and then turned and just waved at him like a psychopath. And I was like, I think I am the alpha of this building right now. I'm not even paying rent anymore. One last thing I want to say is I've done the show the first time in 2016. And back in the day, I was working at a store here in Portland that sells phones, the I variety. And I remember I was telling them, I was like, I got on the show, they asked me to do it. And I was like, oh, I told them, I was like, hey, can I leave work early next week? Because I have this like thing I'm doing. And they were like, what is it? And I was like, oh, it's live wire, it's like live radio. And they were like, can we listen to it? I was like, no, you know, it's not live, but it's live. And he was like, no. And I was like, you can't leave, you know? And I was like, I'm leaving, you know? And then come that work day, and it was like, you know, 6 p.m. or something. I was supposed to stay there until 8, and I just, like, left. And I'd done the show. I had a great time. And then the next day, I saw that manager, and he was like, did you leave early yesterday? And I was like, hey, man, I'll say this, you know? Remember, like, on our first day here at the job, you came to the training, and he said, we are all dreamers here, and if you have a dream, you should go and chase it. And he was like, yes. And I was like, that's all I've done. And he was like, okay, that makes sense. And the thing is, that man never said that. But I just wanted to thank Livewire for giving me an opportunity back then, and you know, for taking a shot on me. And thank you guys so much. Please have a good night. Thank you.
That was the always hilarious Mohanad Elshaky right here on Livewire. Make sure you check out the podcast Love It or Leave It that he writes on, and also the show that he hosts. You could do that on television. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarella. We have to take a very quick break, but do not go anywhere, because when we return, we'll hear some music from Portland sensation, the band Glitter Fox. Stay with us. Livewire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. They make one-of-a-kind, handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LIVEWIRE, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to Livewire from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarella. Before we get to our musical guest this week, a little preview of what we're doing on the program next week. We are going to be talking to the comedian Gary Gulman. He's been on every late night television show multiple times. You might know him from those appearances or maybe his HBO special, The Great Depression. And he's got a book out now. It's a memoir. It's called Misfit, Growing Up Awkward in the 80s. And it talks about his childhood in Massachusetts, but it also gets into his adult life, his depression that he dealt with, which actually landed him eventually in the psych ward, where he writes he got recognized as a celebrity, which is, you know, an unusual place to have that happen. We're also going to talk to our friend, the award-winning poet Anis Mojgani, about what it's like to actually be the poet laureate of a state. And we're going to get some music from a singer, songwriter, and TikTok sensation, Olive Klug. It's going to be a really great show that you do not want to miss. As always, we would like to get your answers to our listener question. Lena, what are we asking the Livewire listeners for next week's show?
Oh, this is going to be a feel-gooder. We would like you to please tell us about a meaningful thing that someone did to cheer you up when you were having a hard time.
Always useful information.
Yeah, Dairy Queen Blizzard. That's what anyone can do to cheer me up at any time.
Oh, good to know. Okay.
Yeah, I love those.
All right. We'll put that in your rider for craft services backstage at the show. All right. If you have a response to that listener question, go ahead and hit us up on social media. We are at Livewire Radio pretty much everywhere. All right. Our musical guests this week are an indie folk act. They were named one of Portland's best new bands by the Willamette Week, and their sound has been described as West Coast indie meets Southern Americana songwriting. That's all stuff that I love, all mixed together. Their latest single, Highway Forever, is out now on Hill Rock Stars. This is Glitter Fox, who joined us on stage at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
All right, what song are we going to hear?
This song's called TV. It's a single we put out in October on our new record label, which is Kill Rock Stars.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, this is Glitter Fox here on Livewire. That was Glitter Fox right here on Livewire. They've got a new song out. It's called Portland. It is very good. It is very Portlandy, and you should be sure to check it out wherever you get your music stuff. All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Livewire. A very, very big thanks to our guests, Moshe Kesher, Mohanid Elshaki, and Glitter Fox.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer, Heather D. Michelle is our executive director, and our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko. Eben Hoffer, Leona Skinner-Kinderman, and Molly Pettit are our technical directors, and our house sound is by D. Neil Blake. Trey Hester is our assistant editor, our marketing and production manager is Karen Pan, Rosa Garcia is our operations associate, Jackie Ibarra is our production fellow, and Becky Phillips is our intern. Our house band is Ethan Fox Tucker, Sam Tucker, A.L. Alves, and A. Walker Spring, who also composes our music. This episode was mixed by Molly Pettit and Trey Hester.
Additional funding provided by the Marie Lampfrom Charitable Foundation. Livewire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we'd like to thank members Pamela Brown of Tigard, Oregon, and Michael Smith of Everett, Washington. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, head on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank for Elena Passarello and the whole Livewire team. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Dear Livewire, when we first met, I was really shy. I had no idea we'd spend so much time together or that you'd be one to fill my heart with joy and make me want to be a better person. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were here. I was busy reading a review from one of our many, many rapturously smitten listeners. Oh, wait, actually, no, sorry. This is from Elena. Anyway, the point is, it would be really helpful if you wanted to leave us a review. Feel free to say really nice things about us, and we'll even read them now and then on the show, so you might hear your review of Livewire read on the program itself. Reviews help other people hear about the show, and then we can keep doing this for a long, long time, because we love having this job. Thank you so much if you've left a review, and if you're about to leave a review, you can go ahead and do it right where you get the podcast.